Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nadia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, who talks about the reasons behind the popularity and exponential growth of the Occupy Wall Street movement nationwide. Voices of Occupy Wall Street protesters who attended a march and rally co-organized by New York City labor unions on October 5th. And Andy Kroll, a reporter with Mother Jones Magazine, who discusses the grim economic statistics he gathered, which illustrates the severe decline of America's middle class. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the sprawling suburbs of Madrid, Spain, security guard Rolando Jimenez is trying to get back into the apartment he lost to foreclosure. He bought the house in 2006, with a mortgage from a local bank. Europe's economy plummeted after the fall of Lehman Brothers in 2008. Credit dried up, and Jimenez could not keep up with his mortgage payments. Unlike the process in the U.S., Spanish homeowners owe banks the unpaid balance even after foreclosure, and Jimenez and his wife still owe 115,000 euros on their foreclosed apartment. According to The Nation magazine, nearly a million homes remained empty in European nations besieged by the debt crisis, with Spain, Portugal, Greece, and Ireland being the hardest hit. Spanish activists have launched the Platform for Mortgage Victims, which is demanding relief for homeowners facing foreclosure. Over the last 6 months, more than 20,000 families in Spain were evicted from their homes. In the early days of the euro, cheap money flowing into the poorer European nations distorted development policies and fueled real estate speculation. Activists in indebted EU countries find themselves in a situation similar to that of Latin America in the 1980s and 90s. Today, some European progressives favor defaulting on their nation's debt, following the example of Argentina and Ecuador, who refused to pay what many considered at the time to be an unfair and unsustainable external debt burden. China is crying foul over a decision by Myanmar's new president, Thein Sein, to halt construction of a $3.6 billion Chinese-financed hydroelectric power dam known as the Myat Soan Project. Thein Sein canceled the hydro project because he said it was against the will of the people. The dam on Myanmar's Irrawaddy River drew opposition from pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, environmental campaigners, and the Kachin people, who have waged a long-running insurgency against the military-controlled government. According to the activist group International Rivers, the Myat Soan project would have flooded an area the size of New York City, displaced 10,000 Kachin people, and endangered the survival of Kachin culture. China's foreign ministry has now called for consultations over the issue. In Beijing, there is now growing nervousness over other big infrastructure projects underway in this country, formerly known as Burma, such as the current construction of an oil pipeline that is part of the plan to spur development in southwest China. China, currently the largest foreign investor in Burma, is facing growing hostility due to its dominance over this impoverished Southeast Asian country's economy. According to E, the environmental magazine, Utah is home to some of the biggest tar sands deposits in the United States. An estimated 12 to 19 billion barrels of oil are buried under state lands in the form of bitumen, which requires large amounts of fresh water to extract the oil from the mixture of sand, clay, and tar. Canadian mining company Earth Energy Resources won a permit in 2009 to begin exploration of tar sands in Utah, with full-scale production scheduled to start in early 2012. Two local environmental groups, Living Rivers and Western Resource Advocates, say the mining operation would pollute regional water supplies. Earth Energy Resources says it has developed a process that will use less water than Canadian tar sands mining operations by recycling water and organic solvents used in extracting the oil. Meanwhile, environmental groups, not satisfied by the company's claims, have filed an appeal with the Utah Division of Water Quality, charging that the agency was not properly consulted during the permitting process. But many observers say that eco-activists are fighting an uphill battle, since the state is generally supportive of issuing permits to new unconventional mining techniques, including oil shale operations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The exponential growth of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement across the U.S. was a surprise to both organizers and activists, now gratified that their message targeting Wall Street greed in America's corrupt political system has struck a chord among so many Americans. Now in its fourth week, the occupation model that launched the movement in New York City's Zuccotti Park has now spread to dozens of cities coast to coast, with new organizing committees forming every day. While instances of police violence and mass arrests of hundreds of occupation activists in New York City, Boston, Des Moines, and other cities has captured headlines, the attempt to crack down on the protest movement has done little to deter large numbers of Americans from being drawn to participate. In Washington, D.C., the occupiers of Freedom Plaza on Pennsylvania Avenue were surprised when U.S. Park Police extended a permit to activists to stay there up to 4 more months. Conservative commentators and Republican politicians feeling growing concern that this new movement could have a profound effect on national politics have been quick to heap scorn on the Occupy activists. GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney has labeled the movement as a dangerous expression of class warfare, while candidate Herman Cain has called the protesters anti-American. Your reporter spoke with longtime peace and social justice activist Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange, who helped organize the occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. Here she talks about why the occupation protest actions have had so much resonance with the American people and the future direction of this new populist movement.
We are on Pennsylvania Avenue. I want your listeners to just think about it. We are camped out on Pennsylvania Avenue in the heart of this nation's capital. The fact that today the park police, who were ready to throw us out last night because we had a 4-day permit that expired, met with us today, and without us even asking, we were not going to ask for a permit. We were going to stay here unpermitted, willing to go to jail. And they came and said, well, without you even asking, we have extended your permit for 4 months. A pretty extraordinary development. We will be on the square now for quite a long time, and building a community in an area that is not known for this kind of thing, to put it mildly. This is the center of dog-eat-dog power. This is the center of hypocrisy. While Wall Street is the center of corruption, we've got not only our corruption here, but we've got the great hypocrites that pretend to represent the people and instead represent the Wall Street and the other titans of industry. So to be camped out right on Pennsylvania with police saying we could be here for another 4 months, Scott, we have a great food tent, and I just went up to get some food, and they said, we have ice cream for dessert. And I said, who donated that? They said, the police did. So we're seeing magic happen here, as it's happened all throughout North Africa and is happening in New York every single day. The magic is coming to the nation's capital.
Medea, what do you think the timing of all this is? A lot of activists were frustrated that there wasn't more action in the streets after this huge economic collapse in late 2007, early 2008. And why do you think the time was right now for the actions to take off at such a fever pitch all across the country, dozens and dozens of cities jumping on board? What about the timing here is right, do you think?
I think there is a tremendous frustration that has been growing. It really needed the right moment to ignite it and the right symbolism. And I think Wall Street is the right symbolism for it. I think the fact that we are starting to get into another round of elections that people are really disgusted about, it took time for many people who were Obama supporters to start realizing that being quiet was not helping, that it was important to mobilize separate from the Democratic Party, that it, as we go into election season, we can't be co-opted by the sucking sound of people dropping everything, all of their issues, to get another Democrat elected to either the presidency or to take over the House, that this has to be independent. So I think there's a number of factors that came together to make this the right timing, but part of it is that it had to sink in for people that Obama is not going to either end the wars save the environment, provide workers with the kind of rights that they need, et cetera, et cetera. And that if we rely on Democratic Party-affiliated organizations, they're just going to take us in the wrong direction.
Mendia, here's another question. As someone who's got vast experience in organizing on political and social issues, what are the key elements in your mind to developing a long-term strategy and to avoid the pitfalls of other movements in the past that have fizzled? What's your advice to the young people especially who are organizing something this momentous for the first time?
I would say don't get corrupted by electoral politics. Build a movement that is independent of the Democratic Party, well, certainly, of course, the Republican Party, but even third parties. We need a voice that does not get reflected by people in office, but pushes everybody that is in office. We need movements that cross issues that nobody should say anymore. The most important issue is X, because it's not. You know, we're tired of people saying the most important issue is democratizing the media. The most important issue is getting money out of politics. The most important issue is ending the war. There is no one issue. That as progressives, we have to recognize that our issues are all related to each other. And right now, we have the opportunity to make the connections that we've been talking about and yearning for so many years. So I would say don't lose this moment. Keep the momentum building. And keep that idea that we can build coalitions that with lots of overlapping issues without giving up the issue that is most near and dear to our heart, that is absolutely true, that we are greater than the sum of our parts when we come together in that spirit of collaboration.
That was Mendia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. Learn more about the growing Occupy Wall Street movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Less than a month old, the new Occupy Wall Street protests spreading like wildfire across the U.S. have already had a profound effect on the national debate, which up until a few weeks ago centered in Washington around budget cuts and slashing social safety net programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. With its newfound power to influence, the direct action movement has attracted new allies in labor unions that have made common cause with the protesters' grievances against Wall Street greed and political corruption. In New York City, labor unions joined Occupy activists for a march and rally on October 5th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and interviewed people of all ages from all walks of life and from three continents. Thousands of people rallied at Foley Square, then marched from City Hall past Zuccotti Park, renamed Liberty Plaza, where the Occupy movement encampment was born, onto Wall Street. There, two dozen protesters were beaten, pepper sprayed, and arrested when they tried to cross police barricades, preventing them from walking down the famous street that symbolizes the greed they were protesting against. Here, Melinda Tuhus talks with protest participant and recent college grad, Marty Peters.
I just graduated in May. I came home. There's not much work to find. I got a job, luckily, through my mom. But for now, I'm just living at home and trying to save money. And pretty soon, I have my debts to pay off. Another 15 grand, you know. And I'm one of the lucky ones, you know. I know a lot of my friends. I know a friend who went to Boston University. She's well in debt. Over $50,000, I've heard. You know, and I don't know what she's going to do, you know. It's like she's in a really bad spot, and a lot of us are. And it's frustrating, you know. Most of my friends, we hung out last night, and we didn't have, you know, we were talking about how nobody has jobs, we can't find anything, and all we do is just sit around, and I mean, it's kind of a bummer, you know. And so I'm just happy to finally go out to this march and just do something, say something, you know. Finally, somebody's doing and saying something.
We've been in a recession now most of the time you've been in college.
Yeah.
Did you expect something like this when you graduated, or did you think it would be all over?
The whole time I was in college and this is all happening, I just kept wondering to myself, like, why aren't people more up in arms about what's going on? You know, it seems like one thing after another really was hurting our country and our economy and our position, our stakes, you know, Even though, you know, this whole the healthcare thing with Obama, like, I'm glad something got passed. But again, like, still, there's so many people without medical insurance. I mean, just looking at statistics, right? I mean, it's like the number one cause of bankruptcy, I heard, is this medical thing. And other countries, like, I went to Europe, I spent a semester in Amsterdam, actually. And it was just, it was shocking that, like, the people, they were laughing. Like, how can you, like, why aren't people angry about this, you know? And like, yeah, the top 1%, like, pays a lower percentage of taxes than their secretaries, you know? I mean, that's just, it's backwards. And it's strange, and the right keeps trying to twist it around and make it some other weird arguments about taxing. It's like, no, just, look, what happened to common sense, you know? Common sense. Like, they should be paying more. They have more. There's people with a lot less who are working, you know, working their butts off all week to try to make ends meet. 2-3 jobs. And they can hardly feed their kids, you know? And then you have these guys who have found a way, a loophole, not to pay taxes. Like, what was it, GE? Didn't pay any taxes last year. Like, what?
Ben Schreiber is a tax analyst with the environmental group Friends of the Earth.
We're out here, first of all, in support of all of the other important progressive causes, but we're also out here because our spending has a massive impact on the environment. We are in this situation now where we're hearing that we don't have enough money to regulate the environment, that we don't have enough money to afford environmental protections, that we're going broke. The truth is that, you know, the Bush tax cuts, the massive giveaways to some of the richest Americans are the reason that we're broke, the reason that we're having federal deficit and debt problems, and they're the reason that people are throwing up their hands and saying we cannot afford to regulate the environment.
So if you had one demand that you would raise here, what would it be?
So Friends of the Earth has supported a financial transaction tax. We think this is something that we should be enacting right away. The other thing that we'd like to see is a tax on carbon, on pollution, making polluting companies, some of the richest companies in the world, pay for the damage that they're doing to American people.
Do you see, with Republicans in as much control as they are and needing 60 votes in the Senate to do anything, do you see any likelihood of anything helpful to the environment passing in the foreseeable future?
The Republicans have made their job bill literally rolling back environmental protection and environmental regulations. They pressured President Obama into rolling back the smog regulations that were about to come out. They have made a big deal about putting out new regulations on concrete and other pollutants. It's very clear that the Republicans have the environment in the crosshairs, and they are attacking it. Unless we come out and organize and we make this a top-tier issue, then no, we don't see an opportunity. But that, you know, that's why we're out here. That's why we think movements like this are so important.
Paul Armstrong is an iron worker who came out to New York from Los Angeles for a job and has been spending his free time at the encampment. I asked him what is the one demand he would make of our political leaders. He had a ready answer.
Corporate lobbyists out of Washington. I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat. It seems to me that all politicians are in somebody's pocket. And it's not right that working class Americans have no say anymore. It seems to me that the leveling out or the eradication of the middle class started with Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics. And it has just gotten worse and worse since then. And for 10 years, we've had the Bush tax cuts that the job was supposed to help the job creators make jobs. Well, it did help them make jobs in Indonesia and China and India, everywhere but here. And we just keep hearing stories about from politicians about how we can't tax the rich because they need those tax cuts to create jobs. Well, they haven't done it in 10 years so far, so what makes us think it's going to happen now?
These interviews of protest participants were recorded by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus at the joint Occupy Wall Street labor union march and rally in New York City on October 5th. Find links to occupation actions across the U.S. on our website at btlonline.org. As if waking up from a deep 3-year slumber to find their standard of living and future prospects shattered, tens of thousands of Americans are now taking to the streets to express their outrage at the reckless and unaccountable behavior of Wall Street and big banks that hurled the nation and world into the most severe economic crisis since the Great Depression. Despite the official end of the U.S. recession in June 2009, a new study conducted by two former Census Bureau officials found that household income declined by 6.7% since the recession's end, more than double the 3.2% decline seen during the recession itself. To better understand the anger seen in the new Occupy Wall Street movement, provoked by the steep economic decline being experienced by millions of middle-class working families, Mother Jones Magazine reporter Andy Kroll researched income and wealth data from the last decade, which paints a grim picture of the harsh reality of today's U.S. economy. Among Kroll's findings were that middle-class families saw a 7% drop in annual income in 2010 compared with earnings 10 years earlier. He also found that poverty, increasing overall, is not just concentrated in the nation's inner cities, but the numbers of poor people are now exploding in suburban neighborhoods as well. Your reporter spoke with Andy Kroll, who discusses the grim economic statistics he gathered, which illustrates the severe decline of America's middle class, a condition, he says, that may be very difficult to recover from anytime soon.
What I did was I looked at data from the census about household incomes and what the average middle class family was taking home in a year's, you know, in just 1 year span. And what I found was, you know, that between 2000 and 2010, you know, the typical middle class family was taking home about $4,000 less than they were 10 years earlier. I look at poverty numbers, which absolutely exploded in the past decade, and really just in recent years, we have 46 million men, women, and children who are now officially declared poor, and that's 15% of the population. You know, if we want to borrow the language of the Occupy Wall Street folks, you know, the other 99% has had a really tough go, not just in the last 10 years, in the last 20, the last 30. And all this information we're getting right now continues to reinforce that point.
Andy, what can you tell us about the growing gap between the rich and the poor, the inequality that's been going on not just since 2008 and the start of this Great Recession, but the inequality that's been creeping along and growing wider and wider over recent decades?
The incredible income inequality we have now is by no means a result of just this past decade, this lost decade that I described. I mean, we're talking about going back to like 1979 is a place where economists like to begin their charts showing us how the inequality between earners and the American population has really become so drastic. You know, for the top 1%, you know, the top 1%, their wealth, you know, the average income that they bring home has grown from, you know, about $500,000 to nearly $2 million, which is quite an impressive increase since about 1979. But when you look at everyone else, the other 99%, if you will, or the bottom 80%, you know, it's really, the line is flat. You know, incomes have barely increased, if they have at all. And in fact, for middle class earners and working class earners, the change in how much money they're making is actually decreasing. And so this gap has been growing for 30 years, and it shows no signs really of narrowing at all, and that's a result of tax policy. It's a result of, you know, changing American economy and jobs being offshored or jobs just being disappeared in general, manufacturing jobs. There's a lot of factors at play here, but that gap's not getting any narrower.
Let's talk about tax policy, because since 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, we've seen a steep decline in the amount and percentage of money that the wealthy of this country has paid in taxes. The same holds true with the major corporations in this country, to the point where we have some companies like General Electric that pay no taxes at all, while we see the burden falling disproportionately on middle class and other working families. What can you tell us about that?
The general trend since the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration really is lower taxes for the top 1%, the top 0.1% even. And as a result, we've seen a growing concentration of wealth in those very, very wealthy elites. And everyone else seems to be losing their share of the pie while the share keeps growing among that very small, small piece of the population.
As you look at all the young people who are attracted to the occupation, Wall Street movements that are sprouting up all over this country, what is it that drives that activism in your view? And does it have something especially to do with dimming prospects for young people who are trying to gather up money to go to college or have graduated from college with huge debts and really see no prospect for a career, for jobs in their future?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the things you described and much more. I spent the weekend in Manhattan, spent a lot of time at Occupy Wall Street down in Zuccotti Park, and I talked to young people, I talked to old people, I talked to libertarians, liberals. Yeah, they may not have a clearly defined set of demands, as they have been criticized for, and as a lot of people have pointed out, is actually a good thing. But the drivers of Occupy Wall Street, of all the other Occupy protests springing up around the country, and also of the protests we saw in Wisconsin earlier this year, is dimming economic prospects. It's income inequality. It's graduating with $120,000 in debt and having to work at a call center or busing tables. It is the loss of opportunity, and not just having someone hand you a job, but even having the chances to go out and find something. I mean, the jobs just aren't out there for young people and middle-aged people, of course. And it really is the sense of drift. It's a sense of disillusionment that the economy does not work for 99% of the American population. You know, the issue of income inequality and the things I wrote about in this article, you know, those for me have always been the most fascinating story and something that people needed to home in on, because since the 80s, this has been the real issue, is the widening gap and crushing student loan debt and economic opportunity. And that it really is the foundation of Occupy Wall Street. It's on the signs, it's in the speeches, it's in the Occupied Wall Street Journal, their official newspaper. And it's really taking the issues that I present in this article and turning them into action.
That was Andy Kroll, a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com. For a link to Kroll's recent articles on the struggle of America's middle class, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446. Or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.